Where'd you get those shoes? Easy. They're from DSW. Because DSW has the exact right shoes for whatever you're into right now. You know, like the sneakers that make office hours feel like happy hour. The boots that turn grocery aisles into runways. And all the styles that show off the many sides of you, from daydreamer to multitasker and everything in between. Because you do it all in really great shoes. Find a shoe for every you at your DSW store or DSW.com.
Local news can come at you fast. Want the latest on what's happening in your backyard? Download the free Odyssey app. Follow your local news station, and you'll get alerts on the top stories making headlines in your city. You can stay in the know, no matter what you're up to, and be among the first to find out when news breaks. Plus, keep tabs on weather and traffic, so you're never caught off guard. To get started, download the Odyssey app. That's A-U-D-A-C-Y. And follow your local news station.
Van Gogh and impressionists speak to me. Van Gogh especially. I just love the paintings that he does. And there's a painting that was found at a garage in Minnesota that's spawning a mystery and kind of like some discussion. It was bought in 2016 for $50 at a Minnetonka garage sale. Well, they didn't know it at the time, but now they're saying that it is an original Van Gogh dating from 1889 that could be worth $15 million. I don't know about investment or luck of the draw, but they're trying to determine whether it's real or not, and it's a painting of a guy puffing a pipe at a beach. Now, I don't know if that's him or one of his other fellow impressionists that were painting at the time, but they found a single hair, a red hair, stuck in the painting. And Van Gogh had red hair, and they dated it back to the late 1800s. Now, I don't know about any kind of, well, I guess you'd have to have DNA from Van Gogh. I don't know. Well, yeah, I guess, or his remnants. I don't know what happened to him. I don't know if there's anything left or not, but either way, that's one of those stories that you hear about, and it's like, that could never happen to me, and I agree, that would never, ever, could never happen to me. But can you imagine? Well, you know what? Maybe I need to start doing that. I mentioned driving around, and I did. Do you ever go do that on weekends, just drive around and look at what's going on? No, I don't mean the garage sale, just to see what's going on, just... Well, I like to keep track of everything, and I drove all around the Pat Taylor School and all that stuff in Avondale, and just all around Marrero and the West Bank and the East Bank, and I'm doing the same thing with Orleans Parish this week. So just to take a look at things. Keep an eye on everything, you know what I'm saying? You can keep an eye on everything. I might even go to Lacombe, keep an eye on you. You never know. Either way, I'll keep an eye on everything. Thank you, Dave. Well, you might be. Who knows? Yeah, we'll take a break. Not take a break. We're going to talk to Greg Upton now, as we're going to do, director of LSU's Center for Energy Studies, talk about black gold and Texas tea, because we kind of know of it. Some people work in it. It's very important in Louisiana, but we thought we'd take a deep dive into oil and gas. Drill deep down. Let me phrase it that way, with Greg Upton, director of LSU's Center for Energy Studies. How you doing, Greg?
Doing well. Good morning, Tommy.
Let's talk about, first of all, the political climate and where we stand with oil and gas leases and executive orders and how companies go about deciding not only where to drill, but bidding on a lease and if they think there's oil there or not. That whole process, because that always did fascinate me.
Yeah, so, kind of politically at the federal level, what's being discussed right now is, of course, The President Biden, when he came in 4 years ago, you know, he really implemented a policy in order to slow down oil and gas leasing and just generally trying to kind of restrict oil and gas production on those federal lands and waters. And so here in Louisiana, how did that impact us? That was really in the Gulf of Mexico. So in the, after 3 miles away from land, that's when you get into the federal Gulf of Mexico. And so there was kind of policies that negatively impacted that. Of course, with the new Trump administration coming in, kind of the mantra, and I think he said it specifically many times, is drill, baby, drill. Mm-hmm. And so we might see, kind of acceleration of the leasing that's going on. So we're watching that to kind of see what policy changes will happen. Now, on the state level, there is the Mineral Board, and they oversee the leasing of state lands and water bottoms. And I think that that's kind of moving forward, kind of status quo. That's actually been really slow over the last several years, especially since you might recall the 2014 price crash, and then we had the pandemic. And so it's kind of state leasing, because a lot of that is in the southern part of the state, has kind of been slow, not because of political reasons as much as just the economics that's been there. And then you've got private lands that can have production. And so that's when a company goes to a private landowner. They will they'll sign an agreement that will pay that landowner to allow extraction under their land, and they'll produce. And the most notable spot in Louisiana for that is the Haynesville Shale, which is in North Louisiana. And Louisiana is actually experiencing near record levels of natural gas production over the last few years because of the boom that's really happening in that part of the state. That's that private land primarily.
So let's talk about just to be factual about this oil production. Somebody texted in and said we had record oil production in 2023 under Biden. What about 2024? Tell me about the numbers on that, Greg.
So just for clarity, most of the oil production within the United States, in fact, the vast majority is on private lands. And so, you know, kind of what influences that is federal government really has kind of very little impact on what that production is on private lands. Mm-hmm. Now, in terms of, you know, so within the United States, we have seen a really decade of increase in oil production that's kind of consistently increased and has continued to increase. And that really started with the shale boom. So horizontal drilling and hydraulic fracturing. Around 2009, 2010, if you look at the 40 years before that, oil production had been declining in the United States, and there was kind of this turning point at that time where it started increasing. And so you had, with, of course, the 2014 price crash, but a little bit of a decline, and then you had the pandemic, you had a little bit of decline, but that trend has kind of been that upward trajectory. And I can pull the numbers here for 2024 specifically in a second, but that's definitely been the trend. And we are forecasting, our center has a Gulf Coast Energy Outlook that we release every year. And we utilize, anyway, it's called the Enverus Podcast Model, and we're forecasting that oil production will continue to increase in the United States over the next decade or so.
Somebody texted in a question. It's interesting. I've got a crazy question, but maybe it's not. Does renaming the Gulf of America change anything with oil drilling restrictions? Because the deals were cut with the Gulf of Mexico, right? Or does that matter?
So I'm not a legal person, but my understanding is that this won't have any impact on the regulatory framework within federal waters. That is my understanding.
Because you would think common sense would say, we all know the body of water that we're talking about. It's not whatever you call it, right? I mean, it's not. Let's talk about the majority of oil that is produced in this country. It's produced from fracking, not from drilling, or from land, or from offshore? And how do you decide what's this country if it's offshore?
Yeah, so there's kind of three buckets. So you've got offshore, so that's going to be, you know, over water production. And then you have onshore production. And within onshore production, what you really have is what are called these shale plays. And in these shale geological formations, that's when you utilize a technique called horizontal drilling and hydraulic fracturing. You might just hear this referred to as informally as kind of the fracking revolution or fracking. And so where's the growth been over the last decade? So what we've seen is kind of onshore production and non-shale, that non-fracking production has been declining. Offshore oil production for oil itself has actually been increasing, but kind of modestly. But really, the huge growth that we've seen in oil production, essentially all of it has come from those shale geological formations, that fracking revolution. So that's really where the growth is, and that's where the majority of oil production today is coming online from.
So when it comes to horizontal drilling, somebody texted in, I think this is a good question. If I own land, and first of all, it seems as though you never get the mineral rights when you buy land. For whatever reason, the mineral rights are never included. But even if they were, somebody can go in and drill horizontally underneath your land and take what's underneath it, even though it's yours. Take me through that, Greg.
Yeah, sure. So every state has a different process, but they're, I'll walk you through the Louisiana process, but conceptually it's very similar. So we go through a process of what's called unitization. And a unit in Louisiana is typically a 1 mile by 1 mile area. And so a company will go in and they will lease from landowners in this area. Once they lease enough landowners, they then go to the Department of Energy and Natural Resources through a very specific process. They're called unitization hearings. And they say, I've leased this land. I would like to establish this as a unit. And then the state will allow them to establish it as a unit, and then they start producing. And when that oil and gas production begins, the revenues from that oil and gas production are then shared with all of the landowners within the unit, even if the drilling isn't actually happening on your property.
Okay. When it comes to determining where they want to make a shale play, am I using the right words?
Sure.
Okay.
Yeah.
Make a shale play, like I'm, you know, Mr. Big Shot, boots on a table, cowboy hat, oil driller. How do they go about determining if there's anything underneath the ground? Do they drill a test hole or something? How do they do that?
Yeah, sure. So the first step is doing what's called 3D seismic. So you'll have an area, and the geologists will believe that, hey, I think there's an economic quantity of oil and gas under this area. And so they'll conduct a 3D seismic survey of it. So that's when you go out and you kind of hit the ground, and the area and the sound bounces off, and you know, all this very big technology. And it creates these 3D maps of the subsurface that are enormously detailed. And there are companies that, of course, have done a lot of this 3D seismic already, and they'll sell you the data for the area that you're looking for. Then you'll have some geologists go in and do some geological research and decide, okay, this is where, this is the zone I want to produce from. This is, you know, how much hydrocarbons we estimate are there. And then once a company decides, okay, I want to go produce in this area, I think there's enough hydrocarbons there, then they will go lease to the land. They go to the landowners and they try to lease the land, and they'll offer them money up front in order to sign the lease, and they'll offer them payments that will occur if indeed those hydrocarbons are produced. And then once that land is leased, then the next step, of course, will be to go to the unitization hearing that we just talked about. They will then drill a well, and you're correct, typically they'll drill the first well to kind of test out and see, okay, what is the, you know, what's the amount of oil and gas that's here? If that well has an economic amount of oil and gas, they will then maybe decide to really drill out, and really produce the area, more extensively, which will, you know, drilling more wells and bringing on more production over time. So that's kind of the evolution from the research to the production.
All right, let me take a break. We'll pick it up. We come back talking to Greg Upton about black gold, Texas tea. And we thought it'd be interesting to drill deep, if you will, pardon the pun, and go from pumping it out of the ground onshore or offshore or fracking to how does it get to gasoline and get in your tank and everything involved in between, and what affects the price of it. If you have any questions or comments, the Elkhornart Jeweler Talk and Text line is open at 504-260-1870. And I will say at this point, we're all trying to learn, so there are no questions or comments that are stupid. Taking a break, coming back, WWL. 9:26, we always like to learn things, and Greg Upton is teaching us some stuff, director of LSU's Center for Energy Studies, talking about black gold, Texas tea. Greg, are you old enough to remember the Beverly Hillbillies? Have you ever seen it or not?
You know, when I was a kid, they were playing like old reruns, mm-hmm. So yes.
So I guess, and this may be a dumb question, but you know, it's never stopped me before, are the days of somebody, you know, first off, was that even plausible? And secondly, is there any chance in this country that anybody could be sitting on a pot of oil and not realize it and become an instant millionaire? Has all that pretty much been discovered?
Oh, there's absolutely a chance.
Really?
So, oh yeah, absolutely. So I think that kind of the way I think of it is, you know, instead of it being, okay, I just had no idea there was oil or gas under my land, and one day it's discovered and I make a ton of money, I think the more kind of plausible scenario is, okay, I know that there's oil and gas under my land. Under current market conditions, it's probably not economic to extract that. But as economic conditions change and perhaps prices go up, and then perhaps as technology progresses, one day a company will decide to make that economic decision. And when they do, I could really make a lot of, you know, a lot of money as a private landowner in that instance. And so, you know, I'll give you an example. We were watching the Austin Chalk a few years ago. Mm-hmm. And that was, you know, going through kind of the central part of the state and up to the northern toe of the boot. There was a lot of excitement going on. There was a lot of landowners that were actually getting pretty lucrative leases that they were signing with companies. And then the oil price dropped and they stopped moving forward. And at the same time, there were a few wells that were drilled that perhaps weren't as productive as was being hoped. And it was kind of those two factors. But one day, I think that companies will go back to those areas and lease. And so I think that can definitely happen.
So that being said, a pool of oil under the ground doesn't know boundaries or what's the word I'm thinking of? Lines, property lines. So with that being the case, whoever starts drilling first gets it. That makes sense to you?
Yeah, so through that unitization process, yeah. So if you go out and you were to sign a lease, typically when you sign a lease, there's a term on that lease. So if company
so that's
comes
subject to unitization as well.
To both to unitization and to the individual lease that you sign. So if a company comes to Tommy Tucker and you have, you know, 100 acres and they sign a lease with you, typically that lease will say, well, in order for you to in order for the company to exercise it, they have to drill in 3 years or in 5 years. And so if 5 years goes by and they haven't drilled, well, you're off the hook. And so if they want to drill later, they would have to come back and re-sign a lease with you.
But what about the people, if that pool extends, that have the acreage next to me? Are they getting hosed in this deal or not?
Well,
it all feeds into the same thing, right? I'm not talking about horizontal drilling here. I'm talking about the oil and gas as it exists under the ground doesn't know property lines, right?
Yeah, so you could think of a hypothetical example where, you know, you're right on the other side of the line of the unit, and certainly that exists. Typically, though, what happens when you look in the Haynesville, for instance, there are many, many units that are right next to each other, and there's lots of production going on in those units. But in every one of these examples, yes, there's this hypothetical landowner that is just a little bit too far, right, mm-hmm. on the outside of the play, who's not within a unit. And in theory, the landowner next door could have gotten a check, and the other landowner next door didn't get a check. But I don't know. At some point, you have to draw the line somewhere.
That's
but
what
you're,
I'm
wondering
you're
about. Absolutely right. Yep.
And
you draw
I do
the
know,
line somewhere.
Having bought pieces of land, that you never get the mineral rights for whatever reason, and I don't know who retains those. I guess whoever has the property originally.
So in Louisiana, after 10 years, the surface owner will be the mineral owner.
Oh, really?
Unless there is oil and gas production being produced from it. That is very different than our neighbor Texas, that the mineral rights could be, you know, could stay with someone in theory forever. And so people in the oil and gas industry have told me that Louisiana's system is actually, I think, a little bit better, in that if you go lease an area in Texas, there could literally be hundreds of mineral owners that don't even know that they're mineral owners, right? Because mm-hmm. my great-grandfather had these mineral rights, when he passed away. Those mineral rights, you know, are retained from all the offspring, and it can kind of get very complicated. But in Louisiana, that's not the case. If you sell your land, you can retain the mineral rights for 10 years. Of course, it might impact the price of the land you sell. This is a negotiation between you and the buyer. But after 10 years, that goes back to the landowner.
And I love learning stuff. Somebody texted in and said, I've been in oil and gas business 25 years. That was the best explanation from start to production. So, Greg, we're glad we have you. Somebody else texted in and said, and I kind of looked this up to make sure I wasn't saying anything dirty on the radio, what is a geographical Wilcox?
The Wilcox Formation. Let's see here. you're asking an economist here.
Well, I just want to make sure it wasn't, some kind of, somebody wasn't playing a joke on me here or anything. But if it's a geological question, we can move on. That's okay.
Yeah.
All right,
yeah,
let's
go
to, is the oil industry going to eventually convert into the clean power industry, solar and wind? You and I had this discussion before, but please answer the question.
Yeah, absolutely. So the way I think of energy is ultimately, what do we as consumers want? We want the lights to turn on. We want to be able to drive. We want to be able to get on an airplane and travel. The source of the energy as a consumer is not as what we care about as much as being able to utilize that energy. And what we've seen over the last really century is that hydrocarbons have been that kind of core part of the energy landscape. And what I mean by hydrocarbons, I'm talking about oil, natural gas, coal. That's when you have a carbon-based molecule that you combust and you produce energy. Today in the world, that's about 80% of the energy usage. And interestingly, Tom, if you go back 20, 30, 40 years, it's really consistently been about 80% hydrocarbon-based. In a future, are we going to move away from those hydrocarbons? There's certainly a lot of talk about doing that and a lot of efforts about doing that. And I think that the share of energy coming from non-hydrocarbons certainly could grow over the next decades and next century. But my guess is that hydrocarbons will be the dominant source of energy globally, at least for the next few decades.
Somebody else texted in and said, wants to know about the permitting process for subsea pipelines. Sometimes they're waiting for years to get a lay in a pipeline in the Gulf, which brings me back to the question of, when it comes to bidding on leases, what do companies do? They go out and or they look at geological formations, and then they decide from that point how much it would cost to get the oil? Because it all seems terribly speculative, in addition to wondering if the oil is there and then what the political climate's going to be. Thoughts?
Yeah, absolutely. So there's two federal agencies. The Bureau of Ocean Energy Management, BOEM, they are the agency that conducts the lease sales. So they put out acreage that's going to be bid on. Companies, private companies, they go and they bid on that acreage. And then the winner of that process will then have so long in order to go produce that area. It's very similar to a lease with a private landowner. The difference is there's this kind of more formal bid process that goes out there. Whenever they want to go and actually get the permits to drill, the permits to pipelines, all these kind of things, that goes to a separate agency called BESI. And BESI and BOEM used to be one agency actually before the Deepwater Horizon oil spill, but those were kind of split up for that reason of having the permitting and the leasing in different agencies. And BESI, by the way, is the Bureau of Safety and Environmental Enforcement. So those are the two agencies.
Somebody wants to know about the gasoline reserve. How is the gasoline reserve?
Perhaps the person is asking about the Strategic Petroleum Reserve.
Perhaps.
Yes. And so that is actually going to be crude oil. Not gasoline. So we haven't kind of gotten into the processing of the hydrocarbons, but I can really quickly. So when the oil is produced, that then will go to a refinery. And the refinery takes the oil to then produce, to create products that we use every day, such as gasoline, diesel, jet fuel, a lot of residual products that the average consumer has never heard of. A lot of those will then be sold to chemical companies who then produce even more specialized products. And so the Strategic Petroleum Reserve is, a reserve by the federal government of crude oil. And the idea is if you have a big geopolitical shock or a national emergency and oil production stops, then you're able to take that oil and give it to the refineries to refine in order to have oil or the gasoline production and diesel continue. And so an example of that might be, a big hurricane comes through the Gulf of Mexico and oil production in the Gulf of Mexico stops for some time period, for a few days. The Strategic Petroleum Reserve in this instance could be used to provide the refineries that oil to make sure that we're getting our gasoline and the consumers have what they need.
Greg, always more questions than we have time, but we'll have to have you back. Thank you, sir. Greg Upton, Director of LSU Center for Energy Studies, 9:37. Time for traffic now on WWO. 40:20 till 10, we are always appreciative of David Hammer's time, WWL-TV investigative reporter, and his efforts. And, boy, he's got a heck of a story to tell here. Morning, David. How you doing?
Hey, Tommy. How are you?
I'm all right, sir. Thanks for taking the time. Tell me about Nicholas Harrison, if you will.
Sure. Yeah, I just want to start, Tommy, by saying that I get a ton of messages from people wanting me to investigate their stories, and I appreciate every single one of them, and I want to review as many of them as I can. But it takes a lot of evidence to lay out a story that's really going to change things and make a difference. And this is one of those cases. I spent the last 5 months looking at the very detailed evidence that was gathered by NOPD when Nicholas Harrison was shot to death in the courtyard by Marriott on Julia Street on December 27, 2022. So this is a little over 2 years ago, and the NOPD had some issues with the evidence gathering that I laid out in this story, but they had enough evidence to show that Nicholas Harrison was shot in the head by a .40 caliber Glock pistol from at least an arm's length away, if not more. And that's because of the wound did not have the kind of markings on it or powder on it that would have been from a very close shot. But when the only other person in the room was his girlfriend, Cache Shelton, and when they arrested her, when they questioned her, she said that they were fighting over the gun, kind of tussling on the bed, and the gun went off. And she changed her story multiple times, and I was able to gather the interrogation video from NOPD through public records because the case was closed in mid-2023. And after reviewing the evidence, it just seemed like the case should have gone further, and DA Jason Williams' office refused to press charges in mid-2023. And so Nicholas Harrison's parents came to me and said, look at all of this evidence here, and I gathered even more than they had, and take a look at this. And when I saw the evidence, it pointed to, and I had a forensic scientist look at this and say, yeah, there was no gunshot residue on his hands, and it would be impossible for him to have shot the gun that killed him with his own hands if he didn't have gunshot residue on them. The NOPD let the woman, Cache Shelton, wash her hands while she was waiting to be tested for gunshot residue herself. And so that test was no good. And they had all of this evidence that could have been brought to a grand jury. And Nicholas Harrison's parents just don't understand, and his family don't understand why this case didn't go further. And when I went to Jason Williams in December and said, listen, I've got all this evidence, I'm going to do a story, I want an explanation on why this was not pursued, why the charges were refused, he reopened the case, notified the Harrison family that he was reopening the case and was planning to bring it to a grand jury. So the grand jury process is secret, and we don't know what's happening at this point, and we will see if they follow through, but it has gotten this case reopened.
One thing that astounds me, you know, and I've said this before, watching old TV shows where you'll see them go to a crime scene, they're walking all over everything, and it was before the days of evidence gathering, you know, proper evidence gathering proceedings. I guess they didn't know what they didn't know, but this was 2022. And tell me what happened with the suspect and washing her hands. This just has me shaking my head.
Right, right. So they did not arrest Cache Shelton. That's the girlfriend. And she had said on the 911 call that she and Nicholas were arguing about breaking up. And, you know, that led to some kind of a tussle, she says, over the gun. But she said that she was standing and ran up to him. But then she changed that to say that they were tussling on the bed. And so they bring her back to the station. They don't charge her. They haven't booked her or arrested her. They're just questioning her. And we have the interrogation video, hours of it. And they're asking her about this stuff, and then they need to process the scene and get the people in to do the gunshot residue tests on her fingers and her hands and to take DNA swabs from her. But in the 50 minutes they're waiting for them to come, she's allowed to go to the bathroom at the police station. And when she goes in there, she washes her hands and she removes some fake fingernails that she was wearing. So by the time they came in and did the crime lab testing of her hands for gunshot residue, she's already washed her hands. So the results of that were no good. It doesn't indicate whether she was the one who fired the weapon or not. And when you fire a weapon like this, there's always going to be some residue that gets on your hands if you're in contact with the weapon when it's fired, or even if you're close. So the fact that Nicholas Harrison, who was shot in the head, did not have gunshot residue on his hands is a very strong indicator that he was not the one who fired the weapon or even in contact with it when it happened. So this raises all kinds of questions, along with the fact that the wound indicates that it was shot from a distance, that makes it very hard to accept her explanation that he shot himself either by accident or whatever while they were tussling.
So you got two parts of this. You got the police investigating the case, allowing the suspect who was there, I don't know how she can, certainly a person of interest, if you don't use the word suspect, but blood on her hands, literally, to wash her hands before testing them. In 2022, I don't know how a civilian would let that happen. Just from watching crime shows, you would have to wonder how this happened with NOPD. Did they have anything to say about this?
They didn't. This is obviously an issue, and it's acknowledged in their own records. They indicate that she was allowed to wash her hands at the police station, and that cost them this very important piece of evidence. So I understand where you're coming from in asking that question. It certainly, this is an issue. This is a case where the evidence gathering was lacking. There were problems with it, but they gathered a lot of evidence that would have allowed the case to move forward, and it didn't at the DA's level with pressing charges. Because as I point out in the story, there's responsive verdicts in Louisiana. If they brought a murder charge against Cache Shelton and the jury looked at it and said, well, we don't have enough evidence to prove that she did this in cold blood, but this, she may have been responsible because of her negligence for causing him to be shot, or it might have been manslaughter in the heat of the moment as they were arguing, then they could convict her on that if they have enough evidence. So the question that the family has and that I raised to the DA's office was, why not push forward with this, with the evidence that you have? And there's more evidence that can be brought to bear with DNA testing and stuff that they sent to the state crime lab. So this case is very much alive now, but it was dormant for the last year and a half until I started asking questions.
Tell me about the wound to his head as well, because that, again, just as a layman, would seem like certainly enough reason to get an indictment.
Right. Well, I spoke to a forensic scientist, Peter Diacek, from the John Jay College of Criminal Justice in New York, and he was very definitive after reviewing the crime scene photos, the autopsy photos that showed the wound and the description from the coroner's office that clearly show that there was no tattooing or soot left on the wound, which is something that happens when a gun, especially one of this caliber, is fired from a close distance. And the wound was very clean. There was no indication that there was any close contact with the weapon. So that is this indication. And as the in the arrest warrant, the police, the investigating detective, Miles Guerreri, clearly says, this means that this gun was fired from multiple feet away, and makes it almost impossible for Nicholas Harrison to have been in contact with the gun when it was fired and when it killed him. So that's a very, very strong piece of evidence. And that's what the Harrison family is concerned about, is they had that evidence all along. They were waiting on other evidence from the crime lab, and they failed to capture the evidence by letting Cache Shelton wash her hands. But they had this very clear evidence that the forensic scientist said and that the coroner said was clear evidence of the gun being fired from a distance. So that's the question in their mind. Why not pursue this? And now the DA is apparently pursuing it.
The other question is, I don't know if this is part of it or not, but I would presume there's cameras all over the place, right, in 2022 in a hotel?
Well, that's a good question in terms of inside a hotel room.
Not in a room.
I don't know the answer.
Not in the room, but in the hallways and everything else, and you could see how she reacted.
Right. Well, so we have plenty of video, as I showed in the story, of her in the hallway after the police have arrived. But the hotel room, it's in the hotel room in the bed where he was shot. So there may not be video. I do not believe that there's video of the actual shooting that could be had. But there's clearly plenty of video of her and how she's acting and what she's doing in the moments and what she's saying in the moments after the shooting.
And if they let her wash her hands, I don't know. Do you know if they checked her cell phone or text messages or anything that was going on with it?
Well, they should have all of that evidence. Her cell phone was not entered into evidence. His was. She was using his cell phone when she called 911. And, you know, you don't want to rush to judgment and you don't want to, you know, I'm never going to do a story that says this person did this. I'm going to present the evidence just as, you know, a prosecutor would to a grand jury and to a jury and have them decide. This is a case where, you know, the concern, I'm sure, from the prosecutor's office was this a woman who was, you know, involved in an argument with a man and the gun went off by accident, and we don't want to charge her with something that she's not responsible for. But when you look at the totality of the evidence and how she changed her story about what happened over the course of the interrogation, it certainly raises questions about why not move forward.
Yeah, that phone thing bugs me because going way back to Vince Marinello, they used the phone and triangulation and so forth to see where he was. Not that this was a situation of where she was, but you would have to wonder if she had a phone, if she sent any messages after this happened, and that could either be used to exonerate her or convict her, right?
Well, yeah, and we do have some evidence that came in after the fact, messages from family members of hers to family members of his, talking about her getting off and things like that. Mm-hmm. And potentially there's evidence from inside the jail when she was being held before she bonded out. So there's a lot more there that they can review. But I just reviewed the evidence that was public record from the crime scene and from the NOPD investigation. And that in and of itself, you know, was cause enough to do this story and to say, hey, here's the totality of the evidence that they had, and they didn't move forward with charging anybody for this death.
David, great work. I got to tell you, man, and certainly some questions, a lot more questions than I have answers. So as it
stands,
and
I'm going to keep on this. I mean, this is not over. You know, the with them reopening the case, now the question is, what did they do with it? Did they bring it to the grand jury as they told the family they would, and you know, what's the result of that? Is there an indictment? And I'll be, you know, keeping my eye on that.
Thank you, David. Appreciate you and your work as always. You know that, David Hammer, WWL-TV investigative reporter, and it just, man, boggles my mind that they would let her wash her hands with blood on her hands after somebody is shot and killed in a room, and she's right there. And I think anybody with common sense would say, no, you can't wash your hands till we test them, right? Anyway, we'll take a break, talk to Noel Norman about what he's got coming up when we return on WWL.